Euclidean spacetime means Riemannian manifold, usually. Might not be Riemannian, I suppose. And we have a space of fields on X. We might also have, incidentally, background fields that we're not integrating over. And so the space of fields, in general, is not a connected space. So that's a picture of Fx. No problem. These people just missed a word of wisdom there. A minute. Good job. So what we need to be able to integrate that, all right, so what we want to do is integrate over the space of fields that were the quantum ones, not the background ones. We want to integrate e to the minus s, and then potentially some operators. Well, we have the usual problem that there's no measure, but that's not the one I want to focus on. What I want to focus on is the formal problem that we can't integrate over something with values in different spaces. So what we need to do is identify all of these lines, just identify them with the complex numbers. Well, how do you identify a one-dimensional space with the complex numbers? Any vector space, you give a basis. And a one-dimensional space, we just need to give a non-zero element. So if we do that at every point, that means we'd like a section, which I'll call 1, not of each individual line bundle, but of the tensor product. So what we'd like is 1 to be a section, global section, of this tensor product. That would say that that tensor product is trivial as a line bundle. I mean, a line bundle is trivial if and only if it has a non-zero section. So by global section there, I meant a non-zero section, because then what I would do is express this element of the line in terms of that basis, just write that as the ratio. That then would be a good function. Of course, we need to be able to divide that the section be non-vanishing. But I want not only to get a section or a trivialization of the line bundle, but also of the metric and connection. So that means that I want this section to have norm 1, that, so to speak, says it trivializes the metric, and I want it to be flat. That says that it trivializes the connection. So that means I've trivialized the bundle together with its geometry. So what an anomaly, the anomaly is, as Ron says, we have existence and uniqueness. So this is the existence question. So the anomaly is the obstruction to the existence of that section. Okay? Now the obstruction you could measure in various forms. I mean, there is an overall obstruction. Either the tensor product admits such a section or it doesn't. But you can sneak up on it. For example, you can ask, does the Lyme bundle admit a section which is non-zero, never mind these geometric conditions? That's a topological question, which is asking about the topology of that Lyme bundle. So that's measured by the topological class of the Lyme bundle, which is an element of integral H2 of the base. Even that question we could approximate by measuring, instead of integral H2, we could measure it in rational or real H2, and then we could try for integral H2. On the other hand, the geometric question of whether there exists, if there exists a non-zero section, we can always make it of norm 1, but is there a section which is flat? Well, locally there's an obstruction for that, which is the curvature of the bundle. So geometrically there's a local obstruction, which is the curvature. That's what's usually called the local anomaly. And even if the curvature vanishes, there's a global obstruction, which is the whole anomaly, in case there are non-trivial loops in the base. And so that's what's called the global anomaly. So when we talk about anomaly questions in this lecture and the next lecture, it's really the full question that I'm talking about, the geometric question, the whole local and global anomalies, locally, geometrically, of whether that Lyme bundle is trivial. Now, that's the existence question. On the other hand, to define the partition function and correlation functions, we must specify this section. So what is the space of such sections in case that obstruction vanishes? So the space of these global bases, well, it's a torsor for locally constant functions with values in the circle. In other words, supposing that I have two sections which satisfy these equations. They both have norm 1, they each have norm 1, and they're each flat. Well, their ratio is then a function. It's a function which has norm 1 and a function whose differential is 0. Well, saying the differential is 0 says it's locally constant, and saying it has norm 1 says that it's a phase. So it's really a phase on each component. Okay. So saying it's a torsor means we don't have a base point, we don't have a specified one, but the ratio of any two is a phase on each component. So given one choice, we can change by those phases. An overall phase won't matter. An overall phase in an action doesn't matter, but relative phases do matter. And those represent physical choices. So in various contexts, those go by the names of theta angles. I think discrete torsion fits into this paradigm, and various other things. So to really specify the correlation functions, this is a piece of the data that you need in the quantum theory, which is absent in the classical theory. Now, so there are two levels to the problem. One is showing the obstruction vanishes. Another one is really defining this function 1 to define the theory. So what I'll do in the examples today and tomorrow is we'll have two sorts of terms. I mean, there'll be theories with very complicated actions, but I'll focus on two such factors in the action. So one factor, e to the minus s, I don't know, gauge or something, will be the one which I've been calling the electric coupling. So that's what I've explained in the first two lectures, and what I'll review right now is how that electric coupling term, when we have both electric current and magnetic current, leads to an anomaly, leads to a factor like this. Okay, and we have a formula for this Lyme bundle. So that's the sort of term I've been discussing. And the other one is the one that's perhaps more familiar, is the fermion partition function. And so we'll see that today for spin 1/2 for spinner fields, and tomorrow as well for Rurita-Schwinger spin 3/2 fields. Okay, so that's an older story, and at the end of the lecture, I'll say some words about how that goes and how that leads to such a section. And so the idea and the problems that I'll discuss is that these two terms, factors, are sections of line bundles which are inverse in this geometric sense. In other words, their tensor product vanishes. And the fact that that tensor product vanishes will actually be a consequence of a geometric form of the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. So actually today, half the time it's the topological index theorem, and half the time it's a geometric form of the index theorem. So what I'll be able to say from the index theorem is that this anomaly vanishes. I won't, however, address the question of what this section is. In fact, it's most likely true that in this case, for this kind of cancellation, there's a canonical choice. It would not be so good if there were some physical data that came because of this particular cancellation. I don't think there is, and there's probably a way to make that choice canonical, to do something more canonical with the index theorem, but that hasn't been done. Okay, so that's a sort of general context for how I think about actions in a Lagrangian field theory in this geometric way to think about anomalies. Are there any questions about that?
I guess I'm sure it's all in yesterday's lecture, some of which I did not understand fully.
That's okay.
I guess the generic question is simply, what do you know about f of x space, finding curvature, local curvature on it? And in fact, because that has to be a very specific thing for that local anomaly.
What do I know about this space?
About defining curvature on it, right? Because the curvature on that space, you say, is going to be
So you're asking whether it's a smooth manifold in which I can talk about curvature, that sort
of
question?
A space where you could put them without gauge drift, and I can imagine this space.
So if you want to think of this as a space with singularities, you might think that, you know, maybe it's a quotient by a group action, and maybe we should do things equivariantly on some smooth cover, something like that. So the space of fields, it's true, might not be a manifold, and then we have to have ways of talking about curvature in the example. So if we talk about connections up to equivalence, then we can actually represent the singularities there. If we fix a base point on each component of x, then if we just mod out by the gauge transformations that are the identity at that point, then that quotient is a smooth space. And then we're just left with a finite dimensional group acting. So we could deal with that using equivariant ideas on that cover, for example. Yeah, so in general, it's true that the space is singular. And when I talk about curvature, I'm thinking that. On the other hand, another way to think about it is we could think about probing this space, so to speak, with probes that I'll call T. So we'll take a smooth T and map it into this space. So that's the context in which I tend to think about it. And so what does it mean to have a smooth manifold mapping into that space? Well, that manifold T, which is smooth, then parameterizes. Each point of this space goes to a point in field space, and therefore I have all the data that I have at that point in field space. So at a particular point, I have to begin with a space-time, which means I have a manifold X. So at T, I have a manifold X of T. And that manifold might vary as I move. Okay, I said that we had a fixed space-time, but, for example, the metric might be one of the fields, right? And we're really meant to mod out by diffeomorphisms, and that means that this space-time, so to speak, might move. So, again, the metric might be one of the fields, so we'd have a metric here, we might have a gauge field here, we might have other sorts of fields. So the general context in which I would think about computing those anomalies is just to have some total space here. In this lecture, I'll call it script x. I usually call it just straight x. And think of that as a fiber bundle over the base T. And on the total space of this fiber bundle, we have all the data of the field theory. Okay, and then we compute, therefore, this line bundle. The action, then, is a section of a line bundle over T. So T is not this whole space of fields. You can think of it as finite dimensional, compact, whatever you like. It might, you know, count several field configurations twice. But if the anomaly vanishes for all of these, then we'd like to think it does there. So that's the context in which I think about it. Yeah?
Maybe a stupid question. But the fermion partition function is some section of some line bundle that you get after integrating out a lot of the field.
So that's for the effective action. So we could ask this question for a sort of fundamental action in a theory or for an effective action. So this anomaly, this electric coupling anomaly, is what you might call zero loop. It's a sort of classical one. Whereas this one, you're right, comes after integrating. So that's one loop. So the cancellation comes in the effective action after integrating out the fermions. Thanks. Other questions? This cancellation is what I call, by the way, the Green-Schwarz mechanism. I don't know if that's what Green and Schwartz call the Green-Schwarz mechanism, but that's how I understand it. So let me, I think that their example, which is the one that I'll discuss tomorrow, was the first example of such a cancellation. I might be wrong. I'm happy to stand corrected on that. So, so let me review what I said about the gauge field. And I should say that I a little bit undersold yesterday's lecture, perhaps, when I said that this theory of differential cohomology is a dream. In fact, I mean, I think probably everything that I said yesterday has been done by Hopkins and Singer, and their paper will be available shortly, so you'll be able to see the full Monty there and get into simplicial spaces and whatever you like. All right. So last time, I said that the idea of introducing these more complicated objects was that we need to reconcile the local degrees of freedom you have in a gauge field. And by gauge field, I should say abelian gauge field and sort of p-form, where p is d minus 1, I think, in my way of counting. And so we have local degrees of freedom, which means we have a differential form. And yet globally in the quantum theory, we have this Dirac charge quantization. And so the idea is to find geometric objects that we can put into this field space here, write an action in terms of those objects, and still have these objects local, which encode that Dirac charge quantization. So what one needs is, first of all, a choice of a cohomology theory. And in the examples I'll use, it's some flavor of K-theory. And we also need maps, which I'll give a name to today, rho, which map the degree 1 cohomology in that theory to the integral degree 1 cohomology, and the degree 2 cohomology to the integral degree 2. And we need also a degree, d, which might be a multi-degree. I also had a normalization constant depending on the space-time and also some coupling constants. And so then the main characters are the currents in the gauge field. So the magnetic current is what? Well, the gauge field is degree d minus 1. The field strength is degree d. And so the current, which is the magnetic current that satisfies df equals magnetic current, that current has degree d plus 1. So this is an object of degree d plus 1. And it's a cocycle. Z means cocycles of degree d plus 1. And it's a cocycle which is in this differential theory based on the cohomology theory gamma. So it's something of degree d plus 1 in x. It's a cocycle because classically the local equation is that dj equals 0. We always have that the currents are closed. Okay, but I really want not just a cohomology class, but a cocycle. So even the cohomology class here gives us, on the one hand, it gives us jb, which without the check, and that's the differential form, the thing which you usually write down locally, except that the canonical one we normalized by this omega x. And we also have qb, the charge. This is the characteristic class. So even the cohomology class of this encodes this information. But there's a little bit more structure there. As I emphasized, there's this sort of kernel torus. If you fix this information, there's still some choice here that's a torsor for some torus. We'll see that torus enter in an interesting way in this lecture. There's also an electric current, which is a similar type of object, but of degree n minus d plus 1. And similarly, it gives rise. So that's, in the classical theory, that's d star f is this. And then there's the gauge field. So the gauge field, in the case when the magnetic current is 0, then the gauge field is exactly this kind of cocycle, but of degree d. And so the gauge field has a curvature, which is the field strength divided by that. And it also has a sort of flux characteristic class. But when we have magnetic current, then the idea is that geometrically that alters what the gauge field is. And this becomes a trivialization of that fixed cocycle. So this is a degree d cochain. That's C instead of Z for cochains in the same theory, which is what I call the non-flat trivialization. Of the magnetic current. So that's, if you like, a geometric form of the equation dF equals magnetic current. So the F is encoded here. And in fact, what is the F? Well, such a non-flat trivialization has what I call the covariant derivative, which is a D form, but now it's not necessarily closed. And that's that's this divided by, again, omega. Wrong page. Okay. So those were the main characters. And the idea of yesterday's lecture was to explain a little bit about this mathematical theory to say that we have such characters. We have a calculus, and the sorts of formulas that I was writing make some sense. And in terms of these formulas, then, we can write the action. And the term in the action, or the factor in the exponentiated action that's relevant, is the one that involves the electric coupling. So again, electric current. The magnetic current alters the nature of the gauge field, and the electric current gives another term in the action, or factor in the exponentiated action. And so that electric coupling is e to the minus si, that one factor, is the exponential of minus 2 pi I times. Well, we integrate, so I'm again going to work now in these families. So I'm going to always work in this sort of family. I have a family of manifolds, and I think of having a gauge field on the total space. Think of that as a family of gauge fields on T. And so I integrate, so these things are really in script X, and I integrate over the fibers of that. I integrate the electric current times the gauge field. Yesterday, I wrote this in terms of the equivalence class of the gauge field because that's all it depends on. But I'll just write it this way because the classical formula that you'll see is electric current times gauge field. And so this is the same, electric current times gauge field. But now it's computed in this differential theory. And so we have the multiplication and integration in that theory. So if you add up the degrees here, then you'll see that you get to something on here of degree n plus 1. If we're working in n dimensions, which was implicit here somewhere, xn. And so when we integrate, we get down to something of degree 1. It's something of degree 1 in the gamma theory. And now we have to apply our map rho, which I didn't make explicit yesterday. And so this thing is then a cochain, because this isn't closed, the A, cochain of degree 1 in ordinary integral cohomology on T. Okay, so that's what we get after integrating. And this J is closed, but this thing is not closed. Its differential, so to speak, is the magnetic current. It's a trivialization of that. And the integration is functorial in the sense that this is a non-flat trivialization of, well, exactly this Lyme bundle. And this Lyme bundle is the same integral where now instead of the gauge field, it's a non-flat section of the magnetic current. So I integrate this. And so this is a cocycle of degree 2 in the same theory. And this rho now is acting on these degree 2 elements. Yes, promoted to the differential theory.
Couldn't you do this without the rho?
I could, but then what I want the action to be is an element in some line, roughly a complex number, but it, right? So I need to have this be an element of a complex line. If I'm working in K-theory, this will be an element in, well, some other group, right? K minus 2 or K2 or whatever of the space. So I need to map that to line bundles. So in K-theory, exactly, you see that integral has a lot more information. And what I'm doing in K-theory, that map is just a determinant. I'm taking a determinant line bundle. So I'm only taking the lowest order information in that theory. Yes, Tony? Well, the same thing. I mean, one of the fields in the theories I'll consider is this field A. Okay. So rather than tell you what the action is, you could take T to be a point, you see. I mean, if I take T to be a point, then this is a degree one element on a point. But a degree one element on a point doesn't vanish, in fact. And this is a degree two element on a point. It doesn't vanish. It's just a line. The cohomology vanishes. But the actual cochains don't. So it's a little bit better to say it in a family, where we see if we have a family of gauge fields, A, and we compute the action, then it's a section of this line bundle with connection.
So what can we just say about the X bay or only the fields? So P is something like a parameter space for the fields, and then you get a trivial family of X's over there?
Yeah, but this makes sense any time I have any fiber bundle here. Let's say the fibers are compact of relative dimension n, and I have a gauge field on the total space, X, A, okay? And I also need this to be oriented for this gamma hat theory so I can do the integration. So if, for example, I'm doing this in K theory, then part of that orientation means a metric. I'll need that to be able to do that integral.
No, I'm just confused with the fact that you chose your fields to be in the absolute X rather than relative.
Ah. Yes. Okay. No, I want it to be in the absolute X. Yeah. So
the X doesn't vary, but you just have families of fields on the X that are parameterized by the field.
Okay, and they're extended trivially in that direction. Okay. That would be one way to say it. But in fact, I'm going to deal with arbitrary families where I have something on the total space, so it's more general. Okay. Which one you should use when you actually integrate there, that's a question I won't address. But anyway, it's done for arbitrary families. Yes. There was another question. Sorry.
Yeah, a couple of questions. J hat dot A hat, and then is then push for integrated and push for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a chain, but you have a map only on at the level of cohomology row.
Right, but it's meant to be a transformation in the sense that when I have a cochain model, it'll give us a map on cochains.
Okay, and then the next question is, how is Li a line bundle?
Well, so I should have reminded you that the degree two for integral cohomology, we might put the Z to remind ourselves it's integral, of a space T, these are can be thought of as equivalence classes of circle connections. That is to say, connections on principal circle bundles. That's how I said it yesterday. But having a principal circle bundle with a connection is the same thing as having a Hermitian line bundle with connection. Right? The categories are absolutely equivalent. And so this is a particular cocycle, which means we can represent it by a particular line bundle with connection. Other questions? So if you wanted to unravel this language, you see, you might, for example, try to do a check picture where you've made lots of trivializations and then try to see what you integrate and how those trivializations, you know, patch up. And you might find that, well, okay, you would get an action as a number every time you patch your trivializations. But then if you saw how they changed, you would see they changed by some cocycle, which would determine this line bundle. So I've said it in a language where that's where for one, we can do that in a systematic way, and for two, where we can just compute using the same sorts of formulas that we're used to. I think of this as a sort of generalization of the calculus of differential forms, but now including the topology.
Can you explain again what the physical meaning of
Maybe better to wait for the example of rho. It's just something you need to define that term in the action. It sort of picks out some piece, but I think when we do an example, that'll be clearer. Yeah, it's hard to answer in general. Other questions? Okay. So there are two more. So this is a sort of general discussion that's not tied to any theory, and there are really two more general discussions we need to have. One discussion is about self-dual fields, self-dual gauge fields, and the other discussion is about, as I said before, the fermion partition function. So I'll give the discussion now about the self-dual fields, and, well, if I have time at the end, I'll do the one about the fermion partition function. If I don't, that'll be tomorrow. So let me give the discussion about the self-dual fields. That's not the whole lecture. And then we'll go on to discuss the example of type 2. Okay, so this, I must say, is a topic that I and I think many mathematicians found very confusing. Okay, so what's the standard example? So let me say this example classically in classical theory, first of all, and therefore in Minkowski spacetime, so in honest time. So Mn will be Minkowski, and n has dimension is 2 mod 4, so it's of the form 4 times some integer L plus 2. And let's suppose we consider a gauge field where D is half dimensional, 2L plus 1. Okay, so we can consider a gauge field there. We just consider a classical gauge field F, which is therefore a D form in Minkowski n space. And we can do our classical field theory. Let's just say we do it with the currents equal to 0. So what we get, we solve the wave equation. We get some symplectic vector space of solutions. We have a representation of Poincaré, so we have a perfectly good classical system that we could then try to quantize. So the equation that we've solved we've solved the equation d star f equals df equals 0. So that vector space that solves those linear wave equations, well, when I combine it, I get a wave equation. Anyway, that vector space is the solutions of the classical system. Now, as I explained, we could also get these equations as the Euler-Lagrange equation from some action principle. But in this particular case, we can impose an additional equation. Namely, since f is half-dimensional, it makes sense to ask that f is equal to plus or minus star f. So in fact, this vector space splits as a direct sum. This vector space is an infinite dimensional space of fields. I mean, this space of solutions to this wave equations. And it splits as a direct sum of self-dual things, which satisfy this equation with a plus, and anti-self-dual, which satisfy this equation with a minus. Now, each of those is a symplectic sub-vector space. And the representation of Poincaré is preserved. So in fact, each one is a perfectly good classical system in its own right. So classically, if we want to talk about the self-dual field, we can get this equation of motion as usual from an action principle, but the self-duality equation we add by hand. In any case, we're just trying to describe this symplectic vector space with the representation of Poincaré, this free theory, and that's what we get. Now when we quantize, if we were to quantize that symplectic vector space before imposing that, we would get a Fock space on that. And the one particle space would be that space with the right complex structure. That would not be an irreducible representation of Poincaré. In terms of the little group, you see the little group here is spin of 2 less than n. That is to say, it's spin in degree divisible by 4. It's the compact Riemannian spin group. And here we can think the special orthogonal group. And this is then what we get is the representation on two L forms. And that representation, which is real, so it satisfies CPT, that's why we need this dimension, but that representation splits into the self-dual and anti-self-dual. That's the self-duality we're used to in Riemannian geometry in dimensions divisible by 4 over the reals. And so the particles that you get here, you get sort of two particles, one self-dual and one anti-self-dual, and by splitting it, we then get an irreducible representation.
But if you're in 6 post-Corky dimensions,
it violates CPT.
Right. So it's only 8K
post. I'm sorry, if I'm in what now?
The periodicity of the representation is 8K post to the spinners that are real.
Well, the question of if I have an even dimensional orthogonal group, the question of whether the self-dual representations on forms, which exist as complex representations, the questions of whether those are real or not is just periodic of period 4. And that's the question of CPT. Yeah, it's just a question about that. Okay, so classically that's the story, and that's, say, the traditional example of what we mean by a self-dual field. Now, what happens quantum mechanically? Well, I've also said that as a free quantum system, that's then we can think of it that way as well. Now, let's suppose we do correlation functions. Does this have two L's? Correlation functions on some Riemannian manifold X, in other words, in the Euclidean theory. So, for this for the non-self-dual field. So let's suppose that we do it for the full theory without doing this. You see, for this field, we have an action, and so it makes sense then to talk, at least formally, about a functional integral and to write down correlation functions. I haven't written an action principle here, so I wouldn't know what I mean by writing correlation functions. But here, then, if we write down some correlation function, then corresponding to the fact that classically the space of solutions splits as a direct sum, you see, quantizing is an exponentiation process. So quantum mechanically, instead of taking half the space to get the self-dual, what you expect to take is a sort of square root. It's multiplicative. And so here, we would expect to factorize this as some correlation functions that were self-dual and some correlation functions that were anti-self-dual as a sort of product. And in fact, what happens is that instead of being a single product, we get a sum over some index, typically, I suppose, a finite sum, like that. And so the idea is that to define correlation functions for a self-dual field, what we want to do then is choose these for some particular index I. So to define correlation functions, we need to choose, well, we need to specify additional data, which corresponds in this heuristic discussion to this index I. Now, that's something that I think, maybe this was well known to physicists. I learned it certainly from a series of papers by Witten, maybe starting 5 or so years ago, that's what one needs to do. And that particular extra data, we can recast what he said in the context of that I've been setting up here for gauge fields. So I want to recast the data that he said in this general context with the charge quantization and so on of this data and of this sort of data of a gauge field. And what that additional data is a certain quadratic refinement of a bilinear form. The bilinear form that needs refining is this bilinear form that matches the electric current and the magnetic current. Let me point out, since I haven't already, that if you have a self-dual field, then since on the classical level, see, we can see it more simply. Since d star f is the same as df, if we now put in the currents, it's pretty clear that the currents have to be the same, because Maxwell's equations were df equals jb, d star f equals je. So if we have something self-dual, the electric and magnetic current are not different. They're the same, or at least related by some isomorphism. So this is a quadratic form, but what we want to do in the self-dual field is essentially set these to be equal. And what we'll see we need, this extra data that corresponds to this index, is essentially dividing that form by 2. And dividing that form by 2 in a mathematical context means to make a quadratic refinement of a bilinear form. Okay, so let me just explain that, just give an aside about quadratic forms and bilinear forms. So let's let B be a bilinear form. Now, I'm not being specific about what the domain and codomain of this bilinear form are, but whatever they are, it's a bilinear form on, defined on some space where I have addition and mapping to some space where I have addition. And therefore, I can express the bilinearity. So you can think of it on vector space, on groups, however you like. In a moment, it'll be somewhere specific. And then the definition, as I say, I'm not being specific, so it's a sort of definition, is that Q is a quadratic refinement of B with a symmetry. I'm not sure that that symmetry is part of the usual definition. I don't think so. So Q is a quadratic form, first of all. So B takes two inputs. It's a bilinear form. It's linear in both inputs. Q takes one input, and it's quadratic in that input. And saying it's quadratic is the first condition, which is to say that if we look at Q on a sum, it's not the sum of the Q's, but rather if I subtract off the sum of the Q's, that would be 0 if I had a linear form, and I add back Q of 0, which may or may not vanish, then this is bilinear. You see that saying that I have something quadratic. Okay? And the second, that's what I think one usually calls a quadratic refinement. But the second condition is the symmetry, and so I want that there exists some lambda in the domain such that Q of lambda minus j is equal to Q of j. In other words, it's symmetric about lambda. Okay? And so here's your two-line exercise, is to prove that twice Q of j minus Q of 0 is equal to the bilinear form on jj. That's the bilinear form we want when I plug in the two j's the same. These j's are going to become currents in a minute. And there's actually a sort of error term having to do with this symmetry. Okay. So what that says is that if, let's say it's symmetric about 0, so lambda equals 0, and let's say that the minimum is also 0, well, the value of Q at 0 is 0, then this says the equation that I wanted, which is twice this quadratic form, is B of JJ. So I'll explain an intuitive argument in a minute why, when we have a self-dual field, we want to essentially take a half of this term. I mean, in the exponential, we want to take a half. And you see, taking a half is what this quadratic refinement accomplishes. Okay. The examples that we'll see today of this quadratic form will indeed have lambda equals 0 and Q of 0 equals 0. Although the quadratic form that has to do with this field, by the way, doesn't necessarily have lambda equals 0. I should say. But the example that we'll do in type 2 does. The example tomorrow, where we have type 1, has a very interesting non-zero lambda. Okay. Maybe I'll skip that. Okay. So the quadratic form that we're going to refine, as I said, is the one that enters here in this anomaly formula. that pairs electric current and magnetic current. So for a self-dual field, this Q enters in two ways. So the first way, as I said in this heuristic discussion, is choosing which of those terms we want to define to be our correlation function. So it really enters to define the correlation functions, even with J equals 0. With, let's say, well, it doesn't matter which J I'm talking about now, because as I said before, there's only one J when I have a self-dual field. The magnetic current determines the electric current. Okay? So even with J equals 0, we need a choice of this quadratic form to specify the correlation functions. Now, this can actually lead to an anomaly. There's an interesting gravitational anomaly, which happens exactly when we have this middle dimensional form. So the local anomaly formula for such a thing was written many years ago. It appears in a paper of Witten and Alvarez Gomez, I think, and probably before that. And it's a standard formula that one uses in computing local anomalies. And I must say that this is here one of the lacks in my understanding, is how to really say what that partition function is in a global way, in the way that I've said. I mean, to really pin down that line bundle. I don't yet know a real geometric way to describe that. But I know at least a piece of it. And Q enters in another way, which is to define the electric coupling term. In the action, which really is the electric coupling factor in the exponentiated action. So that's what I've been saying, that to define this line bundle, we really are going to exponentiate the quadratic form on the diagonal, so to speak, and that means here, too, we'll use the quadratic form. Now, you might complain that, you know, as I said before, we don't write down usually a Lagrangian, an action principle for a self-dual field, so what do I mean by the electric coupling term? So really what you're doing is defining the partition, the correlation functions, and here we're talking about defining correlation functions in the presence of non-zero J. And so you can interpret this statement as saying that what happens to the correlation functions when I shift from J equals 0 to J non-zero involves also this quadratic form. And not only that, but the shift in the line bundle from here, which I said I didn't understand, to here, that ratio of the line bundles, that's just given by this formula with the quadratic form. You see, when I integrate out the gauge field is not entering here. The gauge field always trivializes this fixed guy. So in that integral, this line bundle is, so to speak, a constant. And so the additional anomaly, so to speak, in going from here to here due to the non-zero current, that's what I'm describing, and that's what I'm using in these computations. So in none of these lectures will I talk about an anomaly cancellation having to do with the partition function of the self-dual field. Rather, I'll talk about the contribution to the anomaly having a non-zero current related to the self-dual field. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, so, all right. So, before I write down sort of formally how to say what data I want, let me give one more example of a self-dual field. Yes.
The bilinear form is non-degenerate. Does every quadratic refinement have a unique symmetry?
I don't know. I think not in the generality I'm thinking, I think. I think we could, yeah, I could, right. No, I think not. So the reason that I want the symmetry, in fact, actually what we will need is the class which is half lambda, so to speak, the center. Right? It's symmetric reflecting lambda, but there's a center point there, which might or not be there. That center point is a rather interesting point. And We'll see that there's, well, it'll become more clear tomorrow where there's a non-zero center point maybe in that example. So let's revisit the question tomorrow.
Are you ever going to work into characteristic two?
No. We can talk about characteristic two after the lecture. Okay, so a second example is, let's take the classical, let's do this example simply in the context of a classical Minkowski force space. And what I want to emphasize in this example is why we want that factor of a half when we talk about the electric coupling. It's also a sort of interesting example, which is, let's take just the standard Maxwell field, A prime, let's call it. So that's just a one form in force space. But let's also introduce its electromagnetic dual, which is again a one form. So my gauge field A will now be a pair. So this is a pair of one forms in M4. It's a pair. Okay. Now, normally, as I say, we don't think of writing actions with where we include both the field and its dual. That's something we don't do, and yet that's what certainly confused me. I've seen lots of lectures and papers where people with Ramon-Ramon fields are very happy to write such a thing. But in Maxwell theory, we don't. But having some formalism for self-dual fields, we can. And so that's my self-dual field. It's really a pair of forms, but nevertheless, it's self-dual. And so F will similarly be a pair F prime, F double prime. These are now two forms. And the current J will now be a pair J prime, J double prime. That's three forms. Well, you know that with a single Maxwell field, we did have a pair of three forms. That pair of three forms was called the magnetic and electric current. Now there's a single current, and it's the magnetic and electric current for A prime, or the magnetic and electric current for A double prime. They switch the roles. And in fact, what we need is an involution, a map theta, that takes the current, the magnetic current, so to speak, to the electric current. And so we'll just define theta of J to be the thing that switches. So you see, that's the involution that switches electric and magnetic. I've now switched the role of the two currents. And the appropriate bilinear form that one writes down on currents here, if we didn't have the self-duality condition, then we would have two one-form gauge fields. And the bilinear form is the one I just erased, which multiplies electric times magnetic current. So B of J1 J2, well, that's going to be the integral, again, thinking of a family, now a family of four manifolds over some base. It'll be the integral of theta of J1 against J2. So if I think of the J's as magnetic currents, theta of J is the electric current, and this is electric times magnetic. And that's simply, if I write it out, the integral of J1 double prime times J2 prime plus J1 prime J2 double prime. Notice it's symmetric in J1 and J2. So what is the quadratic refinement that's relevant? The quadratic refinement is simply to take the integral of J prime times J double prime. That's the quadratic refinement. So it's an easy exercise to verify that this quadratic refinement satisfies that first equation. So if we were to treat, to write for this free system, and to write the correlation functions in a Riemannian manifold for this pair of gauge fields, but if we now do the procedure where we introduce this extra piece of data, which is this quadratic form, we sort of factorize and pick out the appropriate I, then what we would recover would simply be the correlation functions for a usual single gauge field. So this is just a different way of presenting it. But it's a way of presenting it in which, for example, the SL2Z invariance is absolutely manifest. For example, you could investigate on which manifolds this quadratic form is preserved under SL2Z, and you'll discover, I think, the spin condition. That's a nice remark Witten made to me about that. Now, I didn't say something that I meant to say, which is that we can write down, as I said, a sort of classical action. But the classical action doesn't mean the same thing it usually does. If we write a classical action for a gauge field, then putting in this quadratic form is really signaling the fact that we're not doing the usual functional integral. We don't want to integrate, for example, here, over both the space of A primes and A double primes. That's double counting. We want to make this sort of square root. And the way that's done is instead of doing usual functional integral, and where you'd sum over the different fluxes, you sum over sort of half the fluxes, and you make a theta function. And this quadratic form comes into making that theta function. So there's a procedure, which is explained in these papers of Witten, about how one makes the partition function, and that has to do with theta functions, and that's where that quadratic form comes in. Okay. Notice also for this Q that, as I said before, the symmetry lambda is zero. It's symmetric if I just change the sign, and also this Q of zero is zero. Now the point I wanted to make is, supposing that I think of this system classically, I'm Minkowski, and I go to write an action. Well, if I go to write an action for A, then I'll write some sort of kinetic term for A prime, and I'll have a kinetic term for A double prime. That would be the way I would usually write an action without thinking it's self-dual. But if I want to think that it's self-dual, then really it should be the same as the system with just a single one of these fields. And yet there are two of them. And so if I were to evaluate the action on some field configuration, I would get twice the answer. So the natural thing would be to write an action which had half the usual kinetic term. Well, now if I want to add my electric coupling term, you see the electric coupling term means that something's electrically coupled to A prime, but it's magnetically coupled to A double prime. So the fact that it's electrically coupled to A prime means that there's only a term involving the integral of A prime times the that electric current. So that term doesn't appear twice, in other words, it just appears once. And so that term will also have to get a half, so I get the usual equation when I do the Euler Lagrange. And so that's, if you like, some motivation for why we need this extra half when we write down this electric coupling term, even in the quantum theory. Okay? And as I say, that's accomplished by this quadratic refinement. So it enters also into that theory. All right, so that's how I understand self-dual fields. And to summarize, I should write down sort of in the context that I've said for an ordinary gauge field, what's the additional data that you need to specify? For the self-duality. So I've said it's basically the quadratic form, but let's make that a little bit more precise. Oh, I meant, by the way, to say that I think I learned this half very nicely in a paper of Chung and Yin. Okay, so in the general story, we have a gauge field, which means we have this cohomology theory we've chosen for the quantization. And what we need is a theta that's going to relate our magnetic current to our electric current. So this should basically be a map from, in the differential theory, from gamma to gamma n plus 2 minus that degree. And this is an automorphism of the theory. So in particular, if we have a degree d, then this takes the magnetic current, which is of degree d, to an electric current, which is of that degree, n plus 2 minus d. Okay? And it should satisfy a certain symmetry, namely such that the bilinear form we make, so x over t is for the rest of the lecture, and tomorrow too, I suppose, it's always a fiber bundle of relative dimension n, make it compact. And if we look at the bilinear form we have on currents, so these are really, these checks are going to get to be a nuisance, but I'll put them in for a little bit. This bilinear form is, remember, we integrate over this. We integrate the electric current, well, that was the result of applying theta, times the magnetic current. And then after integrating, we applied that map rho, which took us from the gamma theory to ordinary cohomology. And the idea is that this should be symmetric. Now, this B is a map from cocycles of degree D plus 1. Sorry, I said it wrong before. The currents of degree D plus 1, not D, of X cross itself. into cocycles for cohomology of degree 2. So when we say it's symmetric on cocycles, it's symmetric in the sense of categories before. So so that means we have a symmetry sort of isomorphism. Okay. Anyway, that you should think of as a symmetric bilinear form, which is what I should have said that symmetric, of course. So okay. So that's the data. So the first piece of data is this theta that's going to relate magnetic currents to electric currents. And the second thing we need is a quadratic refinement of that B. So it's a quadratic refinement Q, which again maps B plus 1 cocycles on X to 2 cocycles for cohomology on T. And it's a quadratic refinement in that sense, so with a symmetry. So that means each time I have a fiber bundle, and of course there are a bunch of axioms you want to say. You want to say that it's natural under base change and all sorts of things like that. Okay. Actually, the paper of Hopkins and Singer is dealing with the case, I should say, of the self-dual field in 6 dimensions. And so they'll be very careful to specify the axioms and so on. And the third thing we need is, well, I'll just say this. You remember that there's a normalizing form and a coupling constant. And for the self-dual field, those are related. This is pi e squared was the coupling constant. And then you remember there was this a hat, which depends on the gamma theory. So for cohomology, that's equal to 1. But for K-theory, that's the a hat genus. And we have to choose a particular normalization. So this you might think of as the free fermion radius. So in the case of a self-dual scalar field in 2 dimensions, that's exactly the condition that we have the free fermion radius. Okay. So that... I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that, sorry. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I was wrong about that. Maybe we don't need that condition. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, it's not going to enter in anything I say, but you're right. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Yes.
Couldn't you say one more argument why this 1/2 isn't wrong, you know?
It's a funny way of putting the question.
If A is constant, right, the kinetic terms vanish, right? And you can just calculate physically what is the coupling of the electric current, electric current to the potential, and you get 1/2 of what you should have gotten.
Well, all I wanted to do is reproduce the Euler-Lagrange equation that I had for a single, when I had A prime and no A double prime.
Yeah, but in quantum theory, the overall scaling of the action matters. So
that's why I put in the half. I think that's why the half is there. Well.
Yeah, otherwise you would have gotten rid of the half everywhere.
Right. Right. Okay. Thank you, Jacques. Okay, so that's the sort of data, and as Jacques says, maybe 3 is not relevant. So the electric coupling that e to the minus s that we had before is now the exponential of minus 2 pi I times exactly this quadratic form applied to the gauge field. So before, what we applied is the electric current times the gauge field. But now remember that that's equal to B applied to JJ. Because remember, I should have said that formally we want to think of JE as being theta of JB. So really, the old electric coupling is B applied to J, J, where that J is JB. Well, now the gauge field A is a trivialization of JB. This quadratic form is meant to be a map of categories, so it maps trivializations. So we can apply the quadratic form to A, and that's the notion of taking the half. And this is a section, or a non-flat trivialization, of the Lyme bundle, which now has the formula exponential of minus 2 pi I, this quadratic form, applied to the current. So when we have a current for a self-dual field, again, there's only one current. That's the formula for the Lyme bundle. Okay? So that's the anomaly formula. And in the usual case, in the non-self-dual case, we only had an anomaly when there's both electric and magnetic current. For a self-dual field, we always have both, simultaneously or neither. So for a self-dual field, when we have something charged under a self-dual field, then we can always expect to encounter this anomaly. Okay, so I'm finally ready after to start the type 2 example, but I'll pause again for questions. So what time did I start? I'm supposed to end at 10 past. Okay. Okay. So, as I said, there are two main examples I want to try to say something about in the lectures. And this example is about type 2 D-brains. And it's joint with Mike Hopkins. We wrote a short paper about that. And I should admit that in the paper, we recognize the need for that half, but we didn't recognize that it's the quadratic refinement that gives it to you. So I'm afraid the discussion there, although it really uses the quadratic refinement, was rather sort of ad hoc. It treated it in an ad hoc way. Okay, so for this type 2, let's now end the dimension of space-time, which are our Euclidean space-time, so in other words, Riemannian manifolds. This is 10, and so this will be compact, to simplify, oriented, spin, and Riemannian. So the Riemannian metric is, of course, one of the fields, and when I say type 2, I'm treating the low-energy field theory limit, so in other words, the supergravity. So this Riemannian metric is, in fact, one of those fields. There's a dilaton field that will be set to zero. There's also a B field. So the B field is one example of the kind of gauge field that I've been discussing. The B field is something whose gauge field is locally a two-form, and so the field strength is a three-form. So this is a case D equals 3 of the type I've been discussing. And we might immediately wonder, what is the right nature globally of this B field? In other words, what is the right cohomology theory that quantizes this B field? And the answer that seems to fit is that this should be thought of as a cocycle for ordinary integral cohomology. So this should be. This field should be refined in this version with quantization of gauge fields to be quantized by has degree 3, we knew that, but to have ordinary integral cohomology. Having said that that's what the B field is, I'm now going to set it to be 0. So I could say the discussion that I'm going to say with the B field, it all goes through, I think, with not much problem, but we would have to talk about the notion of twisting cohomology, and in this case differential cohomology, twisting the cohomology by this differential cocycle. So we can twist topological K-theory by topological H3, and similarly we could twist differential K-theory by a cocycle in differential H3. So that's a part of the story that doesn't appear, I think, in the paper of Hopkins and Singer. And in any case, I hardly have time to discuss the case B equals 0. So let me stick to the case B equals 0. Maybe I'll add a few comments as we go. for being non-zero. Say that again? No. Ordinary cohomology cannot be twisted by an element of H3. Pardon me? No, I wouldn't say that's the only one, but it can. I mean, given a cohomology theory, we can ask what can twist it, right? Well, it depends on the cohomology theory, but the inverse question, I'm not sure. I mean, you know, do we know all cohomology theories, right? I wouldn't want to make such a statement. But given a definite cohomology statement, there's apparently, it's not known to me, a procedure for computing what are all the twistings. So the answer for K-theory is that, yes, it's possible to twist by that. For integer cohomology, no. For different theories, different answers. Okay, so the other gauge fields and the ones that are most relevant to us are the Ramon-Ramon. Gauge fields. And here the story bifurcates according to whether we're doing 2A or 2B. And so locally these are usually written as differential forms, the gauge field. And in one case it's an inhomogeneous form. The subscript indicates the degree. That's in type 2B. And the in type 2A it looks like this. So those gauge fields locally capture the degrees of freedom. And the plus is, while we're in 10 dimensions, that's one of the cases, which is 4L plus 2. And so we're allowed, when we're half-dimensional, D is 5. So the gauge field is 4, but the field strength is 5. We're allowed to have a self-dual form. And so the plus indicates that self-dual. Okay. Now, so on the one hand, these are the local degrees of freedom, these differential forms. And on the other hand, the input from many directions is that the charge should be quantized in terms of K-theory, topological complex K-theory. So, as I said, I won't review that, although the anomaly argument that I'll present, which is on the nose, a global anomaly argument can be considered as one piece of evidence, and I think historically was one piece of evidence for the fact that the charge quantization is in terms of K-theory. That, by the way, is maybe one answer to a question. If you were to ask why focus so much on the formalities of anomalies and fussiness about these gauge fields, I mean, what can we learn physically? Well, one thing that's always been learned physically from anomalies, well, one thing is to cast away theories that are anomalous, that can't work. But another thing is perhaps it'll teach you something, maybe subtle, maybe not, about your theory about some geometric nature that you needed to cancel an anomaly. For example, one could hope that in M-theory that you could learn something by understanding the three-form gauge field there a little bit better. Okay, so these are the Ramon field. Now, I also meant to say, so I'll say now, that the anomaly story that I'm telling, that there are several physics papers which discuss this in various ways. For example, the local anomaly in type 2B, the papers of Green, Harvey, and Moore, Manasian and Moore, the paper I mentioned already of Chung and Nguyen. And the one in type 2A is actually a sort of more subtle, just global anomaly. And a very particular example of that was discussed in a paper of Moore and Whitman. Now, okay, so we have to reconcile, as I said, the charge being in K-theory with these local degrees of freedom. So how are we going to do that? Well, so we might think that we should use differential K-theory. Now recall that, let me not write cocycles, but just cohomology classes, that differential K-theory on X in degree Q, that maps to cohomology. So this is the curvature map. Any differential theory has a curvature mapping to the Durham theory, but we don't get cohomology classes on differential forms on X, which are closed. We don't get them of degree Q, but we get forms with coefficients in some ring, and that ring is for K theory this ring of power series in U and U inverse, where U inverse, I'm told that's usually called beta, by the way, U. But anyway, U inverse is the Bott element. So it's the having to do with the K-theory of a point. So if, for example, we take a class of degree 0, so if we took, for example, a J in here, a particular cocycle, then the image of that, which is perhaps called the Chern character, well, this would give me something of total degree 0. So that's a differential form of degree 0 plus 1 of degree 2 times U inverse plus 1 of degree 4 times U to the minus 2 plus 1 of degree 6 times U to the minus 3, 1 of degree 8 U to the minus 4 plus 1 of degree 10 U to the minus 5. Now, the current, remember, is the magnetic current anyway, is two degrees more than the forms. So in type 2b, that current would be have even forms. So the forms we would see here would be a form of degree 2, degree 4, and sort of half a form of degree 6. Well, here we're seeing this spurious one of degree 0, but we also have degree 2, 4, 6, a whole form of degree 6, not half, and then we have 8 and 10. So we've exactly doubled. I mean, the 10 and the 2 go together, the 4 and the 8 go together, and the 6 goes with itself. In fact, if we think about electric and magnetic current, you see if we have a magnetic current of degree 2, the corresponding electric current is of degree 10. The total degree, when I add magnetic and electric, is always 2 more than the dimension of space-time, which here is 10. So if we could throw out the 0 and then pair these up, then that one current would be both electric and magnetic. So what that suggests is that we double up these fields and treat then something in differential K-theory, but together with a self-duality condition. So that will exactly account for the right degrees of freedom. So the idea is to do that and to have the self-duality. So I want to say that A is in fact, okay, so we're the currents. So J, this current, is going to be an element, well, it'll be actually a cocycle for differential K-theory of degree 0 or 1 on X, depending on whether I'm 2B or 2A. Okay. And the fact that we don't have something of degree 0 really means that we constrain the current in the case of 2b to be in the augmentation ideal of K-theory. In other words, when we evaluate the 0 form piece of this, that we get 0. 2b
is excluding one
and d. Am I really? I always get confused about that. D minus 1 would, well, it would lead to that charge, I think. That charge would be dual to a minus two form. Well, it'd be a minus two form. See, the J zero has a dual that would be J12, but it's not there on a 10 manifold. Right, it goes with J2, I think. With J2 and J10. Okay. So the Ramon charges are those things. Okay. So the sort of data that I've said, we have gamma is K-theory, that's the first thing. I've said what the degree is. So the degree, actually I'm taking it to be minus 1. So, oh, gosh, have I said that backwards? So I guess it's degree 0 in 2b. And minus 1 and 2a. I hope I have the parity right. I have it reversed in my notes. So there's a single degree d here. There's not a multiple degree. Even though there are multiple forms, right, it's a form of, it's one single form of degree 0 with these coefficients. So it's a single degree d in the way that I've said it. A single, for example, the charge is a single K-theory class. We also need the maps from K1 to integral H1 and K2 to integral H2. And let me just write that these are determinant maps. So for those of you who know K-theory, you'll figure out how those are determinant maps. Okay. And we also have this self-duality data. And so what I need to tell you, again, thinking about some fiber bundle of relative dimension 10, I need to tell you a map theta, which goes from really cocycles, but let me just write it here, from a K-theory class on X to a K-theory class on degree of degree 12 minus Q on X. That's the involution that when Q is 0, for example, in the type 2b, then we'll go from K0 to K12, and in the type 2a, we go from K minus 1 to K13, I guess the way I have it. And so that takes a J and maps it into, roughly J bar, except to get it to the right degree, we multiply by U to the 6 minus Q. So if I think of this as represented by a complex bundle with connection, then we go to the complex conjugate bundle, and we multiply by the right Bott periodicity to put it in the right degree. So that's the bilinear form that takes us from magnetic current, so to speak, to electric current. And so the bilinear form now we can write down, B of J1, J2, is, well, it's going to be the determinant of the integral x over t of u to the sixth times J1 bar J2, except it's u to the e, where from now on e is equal to 6 or 5, depending on if I'm in type 2b or type 2a. So that's what it looks like. In type 2a, those are degree negative 1.
Yeah, I'm sorry,
what's J bar? Oh, d is negative 1. Oh, I screwed up. I'm sorry. What's J bar? Ah, good question. But let me fix the d here. So the d, remember, was not the degree of J, but it's the d plus 1 is the degree of J. So I had it right. The degree of J is 0 in 2b and 1 in 2a. That's d plus 1. Now, what is J bar? Well, there's an involution of K-theory. If you think of it as complex vector bundles, there's an involution that takes a bundle to its conjugate. So that's the bar, sorry. Okay, and this integral is meant to be an integral, I'll just write it here, in K-hat. So I apologize for the funny looking ideas, but once the physicists decide that charge is in K-theory, then I've tried to say that following your nose, starting from Maxwell's equations, you're led to that. Well, so that last, right. So that integral, by the way, I should say, that integral, the integrand is an element of degree 12 in the differential K-theory of X, except it's a cocycle, but let me just write it this way. We do the integral over the fibers of this family, and we get something of degree 2 in K-theory of the base. And then we apply the determinant, and we get something in cohomology of degree 2, and that's a Lyme bundle with connection. Okay, so that's the bilinear form. And now we need the quadratic refinement. That's the thing that allows us to treat this as a self-dual field. And this is a variation in this framework of the quadratic form Witten wrote down for type 2, which is to notice that, if J is of degree 0, then J bar times J is real. If I take a complex bundle and conjugate it and multiply by its conjugate, then that bundle has a real structure. And on the other hand, U to the sixth, which is what we would have in that case, U to the sixth, if you think about what U to the sixth is, it's actually something symplectic. And so that whole thing has a refinement, even though it's in complex K-theory, because of the product. If I take J1 equal to J2, then that product really has a refinement, a lift to symplectic K-theory. So we view, and that works also in the degree 1, so this has really a canonical lift to the symplectic K-theory and the differential version. And so so we define Q of such a J to be, I should integrate now that thing in symplectic K-theory. We should integrate over the fibers that same thing, U to the E, J bar, J. So when I do that integral, I'm now doing it in symplectic K-theory, degree 12. I integrate, I get down to symplectic K-theory of degree 2. By Bott periodicity, that's K-O minus 2, incidentally. And that might be more familiar. In any case, this thing has a natural Fockian, which is a square root of the determinant, again, to H2, integral H2. And so what we put here is really this Fockian map. So again, I'm sorry that I don't have time to explain why I'm calling that a Fockian and the other a determinant, but when I talk about Dirac operators, that might be more familiar. So now here's another nice little exercise, which is to check that, in fact, this is a quadratic refinement of what I wrote before. Okay, so that's the data of the self-dual field. Okay, so it's incorporating this K-theory and so on. So that's how I want to think about Ramon-Ramon fields in this low energy limit of type 2 string theory. So one comment is what happens when B isn't zero. So when B isn't zero, I've mentioned that instead of choosing K-theory, what we have to do is some twisted form of K-theory, whatever that means. And that means that the currents are now in this twisted form of K-theory. And what that involution does is actually reverse the twisting. So what happens is that although the current's in twisted K-theory, the bar is in the oppositely twisted K-theory, and therefore the product is in untwisted K-theory. And so roughly you get the same story by the time you get there. Okay, so I won't obviously finish today, but I do have time to introduce the objects which are charged under under these Ramon-Ramon fields, that is to say, D-brains. Now, next week we'll be hearing about D-brains as objects in a derived category. But here we're in a very different situation where we're doing this low energy field theory. We're not assuming we're at any classical solution, so our manifold X, for example, might not even be complex. And so what we're talking about is something modeling a D-brain here. And so we'll have our 10 manifold, and inside we'll have a submanifold W. So we'll let I be the inclusion. And this has codimension R. So what's relevant is the codimension. So think of that as a compact submanifold for the moment. And we should think of that as analogous to the world line. I mean, if we were in real time, this would be the world volume of the D-brain. And so we should think of that as analogous to the world line of a particle. And you remember that when we have a particle, that induces a current. Basically, we have a number on each component. That is to say, we have a zero-dimensional cohomology class on for the particle, and we push it forward by the inclusion, and that gives us the current. If we had an electrically charged particle, that would be the electric current. So here, we're going to define something similar. We're going to have some data here, again of degree zero, again a cocycle, closed, which defines the charge, and the corresponding current, it'll be, well, the way I set it up, magnetic current, but they're the same because it's self-dual. The corresponding current is the push forward of that object to the global spacetime. Okay. So what does the D-brain come with? So, well, there are several fields, low-energy fields, which live on the D-brain. The one that's relevant for this is that we have a vector bundle with connection. So let's call Q this vector bundle, well, Q, maybe, a vector bundle with connection. So this is some vector bundle with connection. Okay. So that lives on the D-brain. That's one of the fields that you get. Well, this is several D-brains stacked, if you like, the several meaning the rank of E. Now, what I explained last time is that we can think of that as being a cocycle of degree zero for the differential K-theory on W. So you should think of this as precisely analogous to, as I said just a moment ago, when we have charges of specifying, you know, a number, 3, 7, minus 2, specifying a number on each world line telling us the electric charge of that point particle. The electric charge is quantized in the quantum theory. Here, this is already quantized because we're in K-theory. That's in sort of integral cohomology theory. Okay, and so we define the induced magnetic current, J, is the push forward of this Q. So again, I have this inclusion, and we have a way of pushing forward. Now, when I push forward, the degree goes up by the codimension, which is R. And you remember that these currents are supposed to live in either degree 0 or 1. And so we have to adjust this by some Bott periodicity. So it's that. So the factors are a pain in the neck, but there you are. And I should say that R, the codimension, is even in type 2b, and it's odd in type 2a. Right. Now, let me make some remarks about that push forward. So we need a sort of K, differential K orientation on the normal bundle, nu, which is the normal bundle, to W in X. Okay, so even for a point particle where we're doing cohomology, we need an orientation in the usual sense. And I said in the differential theory, if we want to get a smooth form, we need a choice of bump form. We need a choice of bump form. So that's part of the orientation here. So the bump form is certainly one piece of data we need to push that forward and stay in smooth forms. But another thing we need is that we need an orientation of topological K-theory. Now, what's an orientation of topological K-theory? So the orientation, well, it's not just topological K-theory, but it's this K-hat. And so here's one of the subtleties, and so I'll end with this remark, which is that the orientation depends on a pair, W1, and something I'll call W2 check of the normal bundle, which lives in H1 of, should be W, Z2 coefficients. And then the other one lives in differential H3 of W. So the orientation of a real vector bundle in this K-hat theory, besides the differential form piece, involves these two forms. Now, what do I mean by this W2 check living in H3? Well, you remember we had an exact sequence telling us a little bit about this H3, that namely I mapped out to the curvature and characteristic class, and then I had a kernel torus. I'll write that sequence a little bit differently by not taking the characteristic class, but just taking the curvature. So that maps to three forms with integral periods. That maps onto, and the kernel is now not just the flat gerb, so to speak, on the trivial bundle, but we're also allowing flat connections on a non-trivial gerb. And so that's H2 of W with R mod Z coefficients. So that's an abelian group whose identity group, whose, what do you call it? Identity component is the torus we had last time, but it also has a group of components, which is the torsion in topological H3. And inside here sits H2 of W with coefficients in sort of 1/2 Z mod Z. That's just Z mod 2. And the ordinary second Stiefel-Whitney class of a real vector bundle, particularly the normal bundle, sits in here. It's a mod 2 class of degree 2. So we can sit that as a point of order 2 in here. It might or might not be in the identity component. Which components it's in is capital W3. But you see this, as opposed to topological H3, which only captures which component it's in, the differential group also carries the information, in fact, of the second Stiefel-Whitney class, not just the third. So here's the first place in this discussion where we see this refinement, including that kernel torus, playing a role. So what this says is that we have two possibilities. To be able to do that push forward and make that current, we have two possibilities. So one is that we require that W1 of the normal bundle be W2 of the normal bundle be 0. So that's saying that the normal bundle is oriented in spin, and since X itself is oriented in spin, that's the same as saying that W, the world volume of the D-brain, is oriented in spin. So that's the case I'll consider, and then we have that nice starting data, we can push it forward and get our current. Now, the other possibility is, as I mentioned yesterday, and also today, that we have twisted forms of these cohomology theories, and that the Thom isomorphism makes sense when you have something not oriented. It goes from a twisted form of the cohomology to the untwisted. And so here, what it's twisted by is exactly this orientation class. So the orientation is an H1 with Z2 coefficients cross differential H3, and that's exactly what can twist differential K theory. So we could instead, or we take this data on the brain to be, to live, in twisted, well, in k-hat theory, twisted by the pair W1, W2 of the normal bundle. So, in other words, what we have on the brain in general, when the brain is not spin, is not an ordinary vector bundle, but we have something that's a sort of twisted version by these torsion-Stiefel-Whitney classes. So if I assume it's oriented, so that W1 equals 0, then what does it mean to be twisted by the second Stiefel-Whitney class? Well, it makes sense to say that an element there is of rank 1. That would be like having a single D-brain. And then what it says exactly is that instead of having an ordinary line bundle, that what you have is a spin C structure. You have a connection on a spin C bundle for the normal bundle. So the rank 1 elements here are exactly, instead of connections on line bundles on the brain, they're spin C connections. And the spin C is what you need in K-theory to push forward. It's spin C, not spin. So that's usually considered the orientation condition for K-theory. So that's a conclusion, incidentally, that I wrote about in a paper with Witten, where we computed that from an anomaly in the perturbative string. And this is the low-energy field theory version of that same anomaly, the fact that to do this push forward, to define the current, we need some kind of orientation. And that has a more refined statement in the case when the B field is not zero. So in the lecture tomorrow, we'll treat possibility one, which is to have the case of spin. That's the case that's easier. And so what we have to do now is take this push forward, which makes sense under that spin condition, and then we have to look at the electromagnetic coupling that's now applying this quadratic form. So that means taking this and roughly multiplying by its conjugate, and then integrating that over the 10 manifold. Well, you know that when we discussed point particles, that we wrote the integral over the whole space of the electric current times A, we wrote that as the integral over the world volume of Q times A, right? That's the usual way that one writes that coupling term in electromagnetism. And so similarly here, where we have the current push forward, we'd like to write it instead as this integral. So we have to take the integral of the push forward of Q times the push forward of Q bar, and now integrate back along the normal bundle to write that as an integral over W. And so that's the step we'll start with tomorrow, and what we'll see is we get roughly this formula over W. Now the way that term is usually written in the physics literature is, of course, the version with differential forms. That's the expression that has square root of a hats and the Chern character of q and all that. So that expression looks just like the usual one in this K-theory language, differential K-theory. It looks exactly like the one, the coupling for point particles, except we have to remember that we have a half because we're in this self-dual picture. So we'll have to see what that half means and then therefore compute the anomaly as some kind of integral over W. So remember that when we have this current, this charged object, we have an anomaly, and that's what we need to compute with the quadratic form. So that's what I'll discuss at the beginning of the lecture, is how we get that, and that's one piece of the anomaly. The second piece is the piece having to do with the spinner fields, which also live on the brain. So in addition to this gauge field, there's also a spinner field in that super Yang-Mills sort of multiplet, and that has an anomaly. And what we'll see next time is that that anomaly is expressed something to do with Fofions of Dirac operators. I mean, that's the usual anomaly for a fermion. And the fact that that cancels what's, in this context, an integral in some K-theory is the Attias-Singer index theorem. Okay, so we'll continue there next time.